Hello and welcome to another episode of the NBCSports.com College Basketball Talk Podcast. Good episode on the way for you today. We're coming live from United Center after the conclusion of the Champions Classic. I'm going to be joined by Scott Phillips. I'm going to be joined by Brendan Quinn of The Athletic. I'm going to be joined by Jesse Newell of Kansas City Star. And we're going to talk about everything that you need to know about what happened in the Champions Classic when Grayson Allen, a number one Duke, knocked off number two Michigan State, and when number four Kansas went on to beat number seven Kentucky. And before we get into the meat of this podcast, I do very quickly want to talk about the absurdity of what happened last night with Grayson Allen. He scored 37 points. 23 of those points came in the second half. He made big shot after big shot after big shot down the stretch at a time when the only thing that we wanted out of college basketball was to be able to talk about the games, just the games, and nothing but the games. And the guy that bailed us out from having to talk about the FBI investigation into corruption in college basketball and bailed us out from having to talk about players that are being held out of competition because they took impermissible benefits. The guy that bailed us out from having to talk about Donald Trump going to China and helping get UCLA players out of jail after they were arrested for shoplifting at a Louis Vuitton store. The guy that kept us from having to talk about Billy Preston not playing against Kentucky because it appears that he crashed a car that he may or may not have actually been paying for. The guy that bailed us out for that was Mr. Controversy himself, Grayson Allen. And look, he does a lot of things for this Duke team that we knew he was going to do, right? He is the guy that provides that veteran leadership. He is the guy that understands going through a basketball season and winning a title and what it takes. He is that veteran presence that the 2015 Duke team had, the 2015 Kentucky team had, the 2012 Kentucky team had. The best one-and-done super teams that we've seen in college basketball have that veteran presence. Grayson Allen is that for Duke, and he just so happens to be a player of the caliber that can win National Player of the Year. I don't think that's ridiculous to say. In 2016, when Denzel Valentine won a share of the National Player of the Year awards, split it with Buddy Hield, he went into the Champions Classic, had 29 points, 12 rebounds, and 12 assists as Michigan State knocked off then number one Kansas. Last year, it was Frank Mason who, after a 30.9 assist performance against Indiana in the season opening win, went to the Champions Classic in New York, lit it up, and hit the game-winning shot to beat then number one Duke. And now it's Grayson Allen, who had 37 points in the first night where all we can talk about is college basketball, and the first night where we can finally get back to the games, that explodes back onto the national scene, not for tripping people, not for throwing a tantrum on the bench, but because he is a hell of a basketball player, and that script could not have written himself. In fact, if you had put that script in a movie that I was watching, I would tell you that I did not believe it. The absurdity of how that all played out and the fact that it was Mr. Controversy himself, Grayson Allen, who saved college basketball from the doldrums of an FBI scandal and an offseason that just plagued the sport and all the black eyes, is just too much for me to handle after a game like that. As always, please subscribe, please rate, please review this podcast in Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Google Play, anywhere that you can get podcasts for free. Please rate it and review it. That's the best way for you to give back to us. If you enjoy what you're listening here, it really does make us happy, and it really does help us if you can go rate the podcast, review the podcast, subscribe to the podcast. Those interactions help within the metrics of those apps. So please do that and enjoy the show that we have on tap for you today.
Now let me bring on Jesse Newell, who is the Kansas beat writer for the Kansas City Star. Did I get that right? It's Kansas City Star?
That's right.
KansasCity.com?
Yeah, exactly. You're on top of it.
Let's just kind of go through this point by point. What did you before the game? All right. So we had a conversation.
Yeah, let's start with this.
We had a conversation about whether or not we thought that the line of Kansas minus 4.5 was a bad spread. It wasn't a bad spread. You said that you would take Kentucky, and you thought Kentucky was going to win. Tell me why.
I actually picked the spread. I picked KU to win 74-73 in my quick scout. So close. I thought it would be a close game. the thing about, I think the public was kind of, I think it started at 2, the line went all the way up to 5, but it seemed like maybe a little bit of overreaction to Kentucky at home playing those two games. You see, you know, whatever it was, Vermont and the teams they play, and you think, oh, they weren't very impressive in those games. But there have been times in the past where athleticism and shot blocking has really bothered Kansas. I mean, you look back 3 years ago, that 72-40 game where KU played Kentucky in the Champions Classic.
Don't remind Kansas fans. They don't want to hear it.
Well, it's happened before, but, you know, I thought KU had an advantage here where they would get open threes if they could make open threes, which they've done pretty consistently, and they have a lot of good outside shooters. You know, they might have an advantage there, but still Kentucky wouldn't play as bad, could make some shots, and would probably keep this one close. So I thought it would be close. I picked Kentucky to cover the spread, KU to get a close win. But let me ask you, Rob, because you thought KU by double digits. So what were you thinking coming in?
I did not think that Kansas was going to be able to defend them the way that they did.
Yeah.
I thought that by going four guards.
Or Kentucky wasn't able to defend Kansas.
Kentucky was not going to be able to defend Kansas the way that they did. I thought that by spreading them out and going four guards, they'd be able to take advantage of the fact that they could, you know, you have Svee being guarded by somebody like Nick Richards or somebody like Sasha Calais-Jones. And I just thought that Kansas would be the ones that would win that advantage. Now, to be fair and to be clear, I made this prediction when Billy Preston was still playing basketball for Kansas University. And, you know, before we go any farther, do you know anything about that? Did that surprise you when it came out? I guess what happened is somebody, he crashed a car and they're not quite sure who is paying for the car. That seems like what the statement kind of led us to believe.
Basically, yeah, and this is something that broke basically 45 minutes before the game.
At halftime of the Duke game.
Yeah, absolutely. So something that kind of got on our radar late. We kind of heard about it just a little bit before that. But no, it sounds, you know, like a compliance sort of issue or a compliance sort of thing. And, you know, Bill Self talking after the game just basically said that it's out of his hands now. He's probably not going to get updated on it. It's kind of something that the coach shouldn't be involved with. So we'll see how long this lingers for Kansas. But yeah, you described it well. You know, he had a one vehicle incident, as they called it in the report. And so
I love that phrasing.
Yeah, exactly.
But single vehicle incident.
No injuries, but a single vehicle incident. And so they're checking out the financial part of aspect of the vehicle that Billy Preston drove. So again, it seems like something that could linger for Kansas. And, you know, more than anything, it just comes at an inopportune time because KU is waiting on the reinforcements right now. You know, Sam Cunliffe gets eligible second semester, and then they're bringing in Silvio D'Souza, a top 25 recruit. He's going to about 90-95% chance right now graduate early and come second semester and join their front line then. So right now, without Billy Preston, KU's at 7 scholarship players.
And one of them is Mitch Lightfoot.
And one of them is Mitch Lightfoot, who played
count?
Six. Well, he does count. He played 6 minutes tonight. And again, Udoka Azubuike, God bless him, 34 minutes. I would have never thought Udoka would play 34 minutes in the game when, you know, came to Kansas a year ago at 300 pounds. So credit to him for getting into shape. But, you know, right now, KU needs bodies. And they might not have bodies for a while. They might have to kind of stay thin. So we'll see how ragged and run down they get over the next couple of weeks. But yeah, this Billy Preston thing is going to hang over them until it gets resolved.
What kind of player is he? I mean, you saw them play over the summer. I'm sure you've seen him at some practices at some point. How much of an impact can he have? Because at this point, like you said, they just need bodies up front. When Mitch Lightfoot, and I've been ragging on him a lot, and I kind of feel bad about that, but yeah, when he is your second big, and Clay Young, who is like probably a 6'3" guy.
Listed at 6'5", so probably 6'3".
I'm listed at 6'4", I'm 6'2.5".
A walk-on from Lansing, Kansas. Yes, I mean, again, the guy that knows the system, but a guy that is outbodied by 5 inches and 50 pounds when playing Tennessee State. You know what I'm saying? Like,
That's not a good thing.
You can't throw him in against Kentucky.
That's not a good thing.
Billy Preston, he was going to be the most fascinating player on this year's team just based off what he is. You know, you hear Bill Self almost hesitantly kind of talk about him and just say, I see shades of Marcus Morris. You know, I see shades of a guy that just would take KU's ceiling to a completely other level than it is right now because of his offensive skill set, what he can do. He can stretch the defense. He can drive. He can score. He can run in transition. What his problem has been, I mean, when he can get on the court, because he hasn't played a regular season game yet, was just being pushed the way that Bill Self pushes his players. And the most frequent phrase, I keep telling people this, the most frequent phrase over in Italy during those four exhibition games from the KU bench were two words: run, Billy, run, Billy, run. And again, that's a prerequisite to play for Kansas, you know, under Bill Self. But like, they're still teaching him effort. They're still teaching him to go after the ball. And then there was going to be this clash of Bill Self saying, hey, you got to play inside. And Billy saying, hey, wait a minute, I've always been the 6'10" guy that goes out to the perimeter, floats out there, and shoots jump shots. So there was going to be that clash either way, like, hey, Bill saying go inside, and Billy saying, hey, I like to shoot threes. But either way, he was going to kind of judge, be the gauge of how high this team's ceiling was, just because of the immense potential he has. Could be a one-and-done player. But now, again, that gets put on hold for at least the time being until this thing gets resolved. But for right now, KU needs bodies, and for the next couple games, they might not have them.
Yeah, and how much do you like the small ball offense that they run? Because I love it, personally. I think that you're not a fan?
It's great to watch. It's absolutely great to watch. It's amazing the transformation that Bill Self has made with his team in the last couple of years. They went to that 4-game last year. I tracked it the year before. Bill Self's never had to do it. He's always had 4 big men or 5 big men. There was a year Jeff Withey was their 5th big man. I mean, we just talked about this. Clay Young tonight was their 3rd big man. So it's pretty crazy to look at to say, oh, they've gone from Jeff Withey, an NBA guy, being their 5th big man to, walk on from Lansing, Kansas, be that. But the 4-guard offense, it's just, they kind of just threw it in last year. The previous year, they had only run 8 possessions, the 4-guard offense. Yeah, it was after Fred Hoiberg came. His daughter works in the KU basketball office, came to Bill Self's office and said, hey, I think this 4-guard look would be great for you. And so Bill Self ran it the next game against Oklahoma for 8 possessions. They went on like a 9-1 run. He never ran it again. So for them to create that on the fly, have it, the motion, the dribble handoffs, getting guys driving downhill, it's great. But this Kansas team is different than last year because last year, Frank Mason, Josh Jackson, off the dribble, could get all the way to the rim and score. This year, who are those guys for Kansas that can do that? You saw it tonight. I mean, let me look at the stat sheet here, but free throws. I saw with 4 minutes left, if you took Udoka Azubuike out, KU had 9 free throws total, 7 were from Azubuike. Bill Self has always had teams that get to the free throw line. This team doesn't have a guy that gets to the rim, can get fouled, or can score at the rim like those teams. So I think this team is still finding itself. Like, offensively, they're going to have to play to a lot of open 3-point shots, and they're going to have to be a team that relies on other guys creating and maybe creating to jump shots, just because they don't have the Frank Masons, Josh Jacksons of the world to get all the way to the rim.
Well, we have another guest hopping on with us right now. It's Scott Phillips, my colleague at NBC Sports. If you guys hear anything in the background, we are recording this at the arena. We're posted up on a table. There's a bar behind us. It's not open, unfortunately.
Very close. Dreadful second game.
So, Scott, we've been talking about Kansas and their lack of size on the interior and a little bit about their adjustment to small ball. And I mean, maybe, Jesse, you can hop in and chime in on this, too. He picked Kentucky. If we're talking about the spread, it was Kansas minus 5. He said Kentucky. He did not think that Kansas was going to have trouble scoring. Was there anything about Kentucky that – what about them impressed you? I mean, this was a team that beat Vermont by 4. They were down by 12 in the second half to Utah Valley. What's different about them against Kansas, where they come out here and come within a possession of beating, a top 5 team?
My biggest takeaway is Kevin Knox. I think his ability to knock down 3-pointers in the first half and show that he was capable of spacing the floor is something that was a major question mark for him heading into the season. At the high school level, Knox was always known for his athleticism, his length, his ability to make plays in the open floor, but the shooting was always a little bit of a question mark for him. So to hit those 3-pointers, to make a couple runners, to actually be a go-to presence for the Wildcats was something that I think this young team really was looking for. Knox responded tonight. He was the guy that they put the ball in his hands late in the game. He had the tough runner rim in and out. They only had 2 double-figure scorers, with Hamidou Diallo being the other guy, and Knox really stepping up his play was, I think, one of the positives for Kentucky in this one.
Yeah, it was. And you guys listened to the preview podcast we did with Matt Norlander. He kind of called this. He said that he thought Knox was going to be that go-to guy. I was a little bit skeptical.
I was too.
I did not think that he was as much of a wing as he actually is. Like, when I remember watching him in high school, and my thought on him was that he was a guy that was kind of a 4 that had to make that adjustment to being a 3.
Sure.
And at least tonight, like, he actually looked like a 3. Like, he can't really put the ball on the floor yet.
And he had a couple 2-dribble pull-ups once he got the defense to play him off the line, which I was impressed with.
Yeah. That was solid, but he's not a slasher yet.
No.
He's a guy that can make shots on the perimeter. He looks more comfortable running around on the perimeter than I thought he would. So that was definitely a key. And for a team that badly needs – I mean, Cal talked about this throughout his entire press conference – they badly need to figure out what they're going to do at end of games. And it looked, at least tonight, like Kevin Knox could be that guy. Jesse, I know you haven't watched a ton of Kansas, but just give me some overall thoughts, what you think they do well, what you think that they could end up being the season. I mean, you've been to these events over the years. Where does this stand in comparison to other Kentucky teams that you've watched?
Well, just super young. I mean, that's the thing you're talking about. I mean, I was trying to do the back of the napkin math here really quickly, and looks like about 74
back of the napkin in front of the box score.
Either way, about 74 possessions here, and so you're looking at 65-61, and
after watching that Duke Michigan State game and then watching this game, it was
sophomore compared to varsity.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, and then the other thing is the scoring has been up this year. I mean, if you look across the line, I know Ken Pomeroy had an article out this week about how scoring has been up, not in this game. You know, I kind of did the quick scout of Kentucky just looking at what they do and some of the things that surprised me. But, you know, came in thinking, okay, rim protection was really good. That's what they do well. Allow too many three-pointers, which, let's be honest, if KU makes an average number of threes, a lot of those were open, KU probably wins this by double figures like you were thinking, Rob. So that's something that needs to be worked on. But the thing that kind of, to me, might keep them, and again, when you're looking at 61 points and 74 possessions, coming into this game, the numbers from HoopMath, 48% of Kentucky shots were from mid-range. And it's just with that athleticism, with them being able to run, I mean, I think the question mark for me is, how well can they shoot? Again, Knox, I think that was a big thing for them, that he hit a few threes and he could step outside and make that shot. But late in shot clock, I didn't really know what Kentucky was going to do other than play to a mid-range jumper. And so I think that's what they do a lot of the time, and that's just not efficient offense.
And they need more from their point guards as well. Obviously, Quade Green struggled at times in this game. I think he only had one or two assists and really struggled to get other guys' looks at times. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander had six turnovers, and John Calipari cited him as being a major issue with controlling the ball. And those guys have to get better looks for guys in the half court. Knox can't do it all himself. Diallo obviously had some strong drives to the basket, but he's not really a perimeter shooter or a guy who can create consistently, and Kentucky needs more from guys like Quade Green.
Let me ask you, can they shoot? Can Kentucky shoot threes?
No.
Yeah.
Knox was the only guy who even made a three in this game for them.
Yeah, and like he's not a guy that let's put it like this. If Kevin Knox is your best three-point shooter, you're not a good three-point shooter.
No, not at all.
It's that simple. The big thing I think with Kentucky, there was one point in the second half where they were 8 of 9 from the floor in transition. And they were 13 of 19 from the floor in half-court offense. And at that point, they had, I believe it was 10 of their, I want to say it was like 54 points in second-chance points. And that's basically who I think they're going to have to be this year. You know, they're going to be a team that gets easy offense off of their defense, mm-hmm. gets easy offense off of second-chance points. Because, I mean, when you look at that size and that athleticism, that's what they're going to have to do because they don't have – they are all potential, and I don't know how much production they actually have. To me, what they really need is a guy that is just like a veteran. I mean, obviously a veteran, but somebody that can be –
that would be a good start.
Be a good start, but they need somebody who understands how to be a basketball player. Does that make sense? Like, to me, they have a bunch of guys that are role players. They have a bunch of guys who you can ask to do a job, and they can go out there and do a job for them. Like, I think P.J. Washington can do a job. I think Nick Richards can do a job. They don't really have a star. And that's what kind of gets me a little bit. So
yeah, and you could definitely see with some of the numbers put up by some of the bigs for Kentucky tonight that guys like Nick Richards and P.J. Washington really struggled to score in the half court. They hadn't faced the kind of size of a guy like Udoka Azubuike yet. I think they combined for one field goal and maybe 11 rebounds in 37 or so minutes. Sasha Calais-Jones obviously stepped up and played well. He hit some 18-footers. He blocked a couple shots. That was a surprising development given how much he was on the bench last season.
He was good.
Really, really solid. And if he can space the floor a little bit, he's going to get more minutes. But, for Kentucky, again, as you hit on the head, Rob, I think they have a lot of guys who are role guys who can't necessarily create a shot. They need to have guys like Quade Green make easy looks for other guys.
I'm going to tag team here.
All right.
I'm tagging in.
We got a new member. Jesse is gone, and now we have Brendan Quinn.
Look at this operation.
Brendan Quinn, who is
we're pros.
Michigan, are you Michigan impressive. And Michigan State?
Yes.
I'm trying to keep a focus here. The Michigan and Michigan State beat writer for The Athletic Detroit. Did I get that right?
Nailed it.
You have a very complicated title, sir.
It's an easy job, so we spruce up the title a little bit.
Yeah. So give me your thoughts on Duke Michigan State.
Well, I picked Duke beforehand, and my three reasons were the film that I saw on Marvin Bagley. Michigan State came in with – they played three preseason games and one opening game. And in those games, they shot 29% on threes. Duke shot 48% in its first two games on threes. So one team's coming and shooting, one team's not. Then the other one is – it's hard to ignore 1-10, and Tom Izzo was 1-10, or was 1-10, is now 1-11 against Krzyzewski. It's kind of one of those deals like, well, I'm not going to pick Izzo to beat Krzyzewski again until Izzo beat Krzyzewski again. So
1-11 is not good.
It's not. It's not great. Right. I mean, and like of all the absurd numbers in Krzyzewski's resume, like that has to be up there.
That's really weird.
That's
crazy.
I did not know that that was a stat that existed.
Yeah. So the game, it kind of got. You know, it's really unfortunate about Bagley. That sucked. You know, for all those guys that kind of came here with wanting to see Jaren Jackson, Bagley, Bridges, you know, just star power. That sucked. And yeah. I feel like we got a little shortchanged, but Michigan State, more and more, it continues to kind of look like the team from last year with Jaren Jackson.
I think that's fair. And I was going to ask you, so the big question that I think we all had coming into this season when it has to do with Michigan State was, can Cassius Winston be more of an offensive threat? Right. Can he avoid turning the ball over on, what was it, like 27% of his possessions last season? Can Josh Langford be a guy that you can rely on instead of just getting you 7, 8, 9 points a game? Can he be a guy that can get you 12, 13, 14 points? And granted, this was against the number one team in the country. Right. Granted, this was against the team that has arguably the best starting five in college basketball. They didn't get it done. So is this, I mean, you've been around this team, you've been around practice. Is this something that you expected? Are you a little bit disappointed with the effort they have? Or is this just the kind of thing where, you know, a big game against a number one team, sometimes guys just don't
play? No, I think Duke's a better team. I think it has more talent. The thing is, you know, for Michigan State, though, like that is their standard right now. You don't get a guy like Bridges back to be the second best team in the country. Like the minute he came back, that changed the game. And so that means that Winston had to be better. Langford had to be better. Ward had to be better. Stay on the court. You know, the ceiling of this team, I think, is to be the national champion.
Oh, absolutely.
So
they're my pick. So they got to get it done.
You know,
they can't be wrong.
So you got to win a game. Like, you know, right. Okay. This game doesn't really mean anything in the grand scheme of things, but at some point this team needs to put it together and win a game like this. Like, since that freshman class came in last year, they've beaten two ranked teams, Minnesota and Wisconsin at home last year in kind of middling games. And, like, that's it. They played Kansas in the tournament. They played Kentucky last year. They played Duke twice. And were never remotely close to the level that the opponent was at.
Yeah.
So it's like, if not now, when? Right.
And how many more opportunities is Michigan State really going to have to face elite level competition? The Big Ten is definitely down this season. Some talent with Northwestern and Minnesota and Purdue, but you know, they don't necessarily have that juggernaut Big Ten schedule. PK80, they open with DePaul, obviously some tough teams in that bracket. Right. How many more tough games do you see Michigan State playing that could serve as a measuring stick like tonight's game?
They get Notre Dame at home, which that's is a good obviously one. A really interesting game, but you know, it's a home game. Like, I want to see these guys go win on the road or in like a neutral court, you know, situation like this.
Definitely.
I think that the big thing with this game was a win, you know, forget about the Izzo record and all that stuff. I just think that a win tonight would have told them something about themselves that now they're going back to East Lansing, still questioning a lot. I think, you know, how you let up 25 offensive rebounds and you play for Michigan State, like, that does not happen.
Especially when Bagley's out. Especially when Bagley only plays 10 minutes and he's arguably the best offensive rebounder in the country.
There are two keys in the game. The last things the coaches said in the locker room before walking on the court was taking care of the ball and rebounding. And they turned it over 17 times and gave up 25 offensive rebounds. So, like, this isn't a group of freshmen. These are guys who have a higher standard for what they're supposed to do.
Tom Izzo's not a guy that likes turnovers, and he's not a guy that likes giving up offensive rebounds. Yeah. So I'm pretty glad that I wasn't in that locker room at halftime.
Mm-hmm. Izzo seemed really mad in the press conference. Maybe not mad's the right word, but I think dejected a little bit is maybe.
Yeah, I mean, he raced through. I know I'm not reading too much into this, but he like race through that handshake line. It was kind of just, you know, basically slapping fives, and he was off the court before the rest of the team was even like done going through, you know, giving props and stuff like that. He was out of there and just livid.
Because that, I mean, that was a winnable game for him.
Absolutely.
They had him right there. So my thing is this. All right. So I think that Michigan State basically did what they needed to do, or what we thought they could do in terms of mm-hmm. being able to dominate in the front court. Maybe the guards didn't play as well. And I thought that if you play Duke 10 times, right, how many times is Grayson Allen going to do what he did in that second half? How many times is he going to go for 37 points? How many times is he going to hit seven threes? How many times is he going to put up 23 in one half?
Mm-hmm.
If you count the 6 points he had in the last, like, 90 seconds of the first half, he had 29 points in the last 22 minutes of that game. At some point, you kind of just have to say, like, okay, maybe Grayson Allen is really good.
Yeah.
He's kind of a ball.
Yeah.
And that's going to happen every once in a
while. Right. Like, what I wrote out of this game is, like, everything's still on the table. Like, this team could still completely put it together, and it could be completely fine. And, you know, maybe this is a good thing. Maybe this makes them angry, and they kind of find something else. Because they don't have, like, that edge to them. They don't have, like, that Izzo edge that I think you see from, like, the super elite Michigan State teams, like, where they got, you know,
really have, like,
blood coming out of
like
their
a
eyes.
They don't
right.
Really
they
have
don't
that kind of. Maybe am I?
No,
saying that too strong?
I haven't seen
I mean,
that from this group.
Miles Bridges' offense came from a lot of, you know, stand-along three-pointers, wasn't really aggressively attacking the cup. Ward will play physically. Jackson's not really a banger. Mm-hmm. Like, you're right. There's not really a Michigan State mentality about them that we've seen from their past elite teams.
And, like, and Bridges doesn't have the game yet. That
no.
You circle and you're like, well, he's a lottery pick because he just did this in this game and I saw it with my own eyes. He really doesn't have that. I mean, the Arizona opener last year was pretty good. He put 33 on Purdue. Like, he's had these highlights and all this stuff, but, like, you've never seen him take over a game against a top 25 team and dominate.
Not like Grayson Allen did.
It's not happening
for sure.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. Like, he watched what it looks like tonight.
Well, here's my thing with Miles. Yeah, I've always kind of viewed him as a guy that is almost like a glorified role player. I don't think he doesn't strike me as someone that you want to take over games.
Mm.
You want him to be a guy that is kind of a piece, and he's going to be a great role player in the NBA, right? But I don't view him as a guy that you want to have score 35 points in a game, that you want hitting seven threes like Grayson Allen. He's the guy that you want to be able to be a switchable defender that's
right.
going to get you defensive rebounds. It's going to make plays defensively, block shots, get steals.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to get out and transition and excite the crowd. Like, I've never really thought of him as a takeover guy.
Mm-hmm.
I've thought of him as somebody who is just, like, a great all-around basketball player. And that's kind of why I didn't think that, like, with Ivan Rabb, it was a risk for him coming back, right? Because we didn't really know what he was. We know what Miles Bridges is,
right?
You know, like, and maybe if he does end up putting together that offensive skill package that you need to be a great player in the NBA, you know, we could be looking at a guy that's a multiple-time All-Star, but I've never really thought that he had that kind of a ceiling. I just think he's a very, very good basketball player, and he kind of is what he is.
Right.
And I don't know.
No, I mean, we'll put it this way. The way I view tonight coming into this, like my pregame column, whatever, from this morning was, is there going to be – if there's going to be a defining moment for Bridges and, like, in his value – is dependent upon, I imagine this is being plot lined, right? On like your mock drafts and whatnot.
He dropped from number 9 to number 10.5.
Right, but, like, I mean, but the thing is, when you come back to school, like, that's hard things to ignore as if you do start to slide. And, like, this was a night, I'm like, this night's going to move the needle one way or another because he's playing a bunch of NBA guys and you get to actually see it. And I don't know. I'm still kind of just waiting for that moment where he just looks like everything that he's supposed to be.
So here's the thing about, like, the way I view him. Like, we're talking about him like this, and he still finished 19 points, 5 boards, 4 assists, and 4 blocks.
Right. But the problem is, like, I don't even know if he took a shot in the first 10 minutes of the game.
Yeah, was he too passive offensively?
Yeah.
You know, you look at the field goal attempts, Jaren Jackson, Nick Ward, both in double figures with more limited minutes than Bridges. Bridges plays 37 minutes. And like you said, he only took, I think, maybe one or two shots the first 10, 12 minutes of the game. He seemed to get other guys involved. Obviously, Michigan State had some things going early, but I want him to kind of, you know, take over at times and really step on it.
Right, right. And if you remember, they came blasting out. It was 8-4, you know, they were running around. Langford got an easy bucket to open the game, and then Ward's running the floor, you know, barreling around, getting buckets. And it was 8-4.
I love when big guys run the floor. Yeah. And guys don't get much bigger than Nick Ward. And the way he was able to get down the floor and beat Wendell Carter and to see Coach K yank Wendell Carter.
Immediately.
You got this 275-pound behemoth just sprinting down the floor and getting dunks. I'd love that so much.
And when I saw that, it's, you know, it's 8-4, and I'm like, and Bridges hasn't barely even touched the ball yet. Like, this is going to be – this is – Michigan State is going to look elite. Like, this is going to be it. We're going to see what it looks like.
Nope.
It never happened.
And, you know, to a point, I don't really think that Duke did either.
No.
Does this
– Well, so there were moments. There were moments that you see it. Like, I didn't even see it really in stretches for State. Like, I saw it in stretches for Duke.
See, I kind of did, right? Like, I kind of – so the way that this whole thing has been framed is that Duke goes out and plays the number one team in the league, and they lose their most talented player in Marvin Bagley, and they're still able to win this game even though Gary Trent shot 3-for-14 and Wendell Carter played like dog shit for 30 minutes in the game, right? That's kind of how this is getting framed, right? Grayson Allen, Trayvon Duval, like, they can still win. Look how awesome they are. You can also look at it as – Cassius Winston didn't play his best game. Josh Langford wasn't his best self. Michigan State gave up 25 offensive rebounds and turned the ball over 17 times. And with 3 minutes left, it was a tie game against the number one team in the country.
Agreed.
I think if you play this game 11 times, we're going – if you play a best of 11 series out of these two teams,
good point, yeah,
we're going to an 11th game. Right. So what to me, what happened at the end was just kind of you know, it is what it is.
Yeah. And look, and part of my thing is, you know, at the beat writer level, when all you watch is one team, like, you just get locked in on what's wrong. And, like, you know, when can they prove this? And when can they prove that? You do – I am definitely a little over-critical, maybe the right way of saying it. But I think I just –
I don't know. I don't think you are, though. I think that everything you're saying is fair and everything you're saying is deserved. But I just think that we're – the end result, I think, is painting a narrative that I'm not sure is actually true for how the game played out. Does that make sense?
Sure.
Like, let's say that Gary Trent.
So it's November basketball.
Javon Delorier grabbed an offensive rebound with 3 minutes left, kicks the ball out to Gary Trent, and Gary Trent knocks down that three, breaks a 75-all tie. Michigan State, like, Duke leads the rest of the way. I think Michigan State ended up getting down by, like, 9 points. It was like a 9-0 run that sparked. Let's say that instead of that, Javon doesn't get that offensive rebound. Nick Ward gets it, outlets it. Miles Bridges goes the other way for a dunk. All of a sudden, Michigan State has the lead with 3 minutes left. They just erased what was – I think Duke was up 10 at one point midway through the second half. And all of a sudden, like, you know, the momentum swings. So that one play right there we're talking about is the difference between being able to say that Michigan State looks like a team that can beat the number one team in the country versus Michigan State is a team that, you know, didn't – get the job done, and Cassius Winston's terrible, Josh Langford, whatever. So it's just I what you're saying is accurate, I think, is my large point, but it's also painting over some issues that Duke might have had as well.
Yeah.
Whereas we're not looking at the fact that Michigan State, who has the maybe the best line in the country, arguably, went out there and just performed that way. Jaren Jackson was better than anyone
along
was
going to be.
Yeah. Nick Ward basically did what he should do, and Miles Bridges had an off night and still ended up with 19-5 for it.
Right.
Is that?
Yeah, I mean, last year kind of still sticks with me. This team lost 15 games last year.
Yes, they did.
And I think, like, the second that Miles said that he was coming back, everyone was just kind of thought, like,
we're never losing again.
This thing is just there. Everyone's going to get better. And there's a very good chance that it's just that last year's team is still this year's team. Better, no doubt, plus Jaren Jackson and plus Gavin Schilling, and certainly a better team. But, like, the shortcomings of that squad don't – there wasn't a light switch. There's no magic beans that make some of that stuff go – away. And, like, there was a moment 4 minutes into the game. I harp on Izzo's rotations a lot, which is kind of silly, but because he's a Hall of Famer and I'm some schmuck in a lobby with you guys. But
hey, look, we're not in the lobby. We are in the concourse. There you go. All right, get it right.
But 4 minutes in, they have a great start, and then there's mass substitutions, and I look out, and it's Tum-Tum Nairn, Matt McQuaid, Joshua Langford, Kenny Goins, and Gavin Schilling on the court versus Duke. Like, Duke's starters are out there, and that is Michigan State's lineup. And I'm like, what is going on here?
Is there anyone in the world that loves anyone more than Tom Izzo loves Tum-Tum Nairn?
No idea.
I don't know. I don't think so.
He's okay as a change of pace guard, but, like, again,
I like him. Look, he's a leader. He's a pest defensively, and yeah, he's a change of pace that can come out and, you know, he got a layup, I think, in transition, mm-hmm, coast to coast on, yep, one, got someone in the open three. I mean, he's fine.
He had six assists in 11 minutes. Yeah, it's not bad.
When Jackson hit those threes in the first half, I think that was with Tom running things, and they definitely sped it up a little bit. Which is weird because it's not like Cash Winston's slow. It's just like he just needs to find that gear.
Yeah. It's just the shortcomings of both Tum-Tum and Cassius offensively are still glaring. You know, both these guys are unreliable perimeter shooters. They haven't proven themselves to be adept at scoring. And, you know, when a freshman like Trayvon Duval comes in and thoroughly outplays both of them, he's able to do whatever he wants off the bounce in many ways. That's pretty jarring to me.
Was he better than – he was better than I expected.
Duval? So – Give me your take, and then up before I, and then we can wrap it up because we have to get to Elephant Castle on Adams.
I have always been a big Duval fan. I thought that defensively he was a little bit underrated in terms of what he might bring to the table. We saw that tonight with his length, that 2-3 zone at the top. Michigan State, they admitted that they were affected by that. Goldwire obviously played some effective minutes there as well. Grayson Allen was active. Duval defensively, excuse me, was so good in the passing lanes. What do you have, six steals, making plays all over, deflections? Michigan State was really thrown for a loop, and I think that was a huge key for him. Offensively, we know what he is. He's going to be ultra-aggressive. Mm-hmm. He can make tight finishes and acrobatic plays. He's called Tricky Trey for a reason, but he's still got to have a broken jumper. Obviously, the free throw shooting was an issue. He can't shoot from outside of 15 feet. But, man, if that guy has a full head of steam going to the rim with the weapons he has around him, Duke is still going to be a really dangerous
team. He's got some dude in him.
Yeah,
he's got some dude in him.
So I think he was basically what we thought he was, just better at it.
Mm.
So shooting is the issue, right? He was 7 for 20 from the floor, 0 for 4 from 3, and like a lot of all of them were pretty ugly looking, and 3 for 7 from the line. So shooting is a major issue, but he's a terrific defender, better defender than I thought, actually. And like that 2-3 zone that Duke played, which like –
do you think he would have taken 20 shots if Bagley was out there?
Absolutely not.
Part of the reason that he was able to beat this player is because Wendell Carter was not good tonight, mm-hmm, and Marvin Bagley was not there.
So Gary Trent was struggling.
And Gary Trent was struggling. So our questions with Trayvon Duval about what happens if he's not the best player on the floor,
mm-hmm,
and he's not the guy that has to be aggressive and going to the basket trying to make plays – because that's our concern, right? Can he be – does he have any facilitator?
Right.
And I don't know if he does. He's a terrific playmaker, but there's a difference between being the facilitator and being the playmaker. Does that make sense?
Sure.
So
that's the difference between him in the half court and him – because when he gets out with a head of steam
– oh, boy.
God, my goodness.
Really all right, let's wrap this up real quick. Duke's 2-3 zone. They – I don't think any of us expected to see.
Michigan State certainly didn't.
I knew they were going to play it. I just didn't expect that much. Because in their first two games, they showed a lot of man, a lot of 2-3, a lot of 1-2-2, three-quarter court. And I expected to actually see a little bit more zone press.
Yeah, it was nothing.
Because Michigan State's so susceptible to turnovers, I thought maybe they'd see a little bit more of that. But, you know, after five possessions of the zone, it was so clear that Michigan State was not getting into it.
2-3 was good.
That was really good. They are long.
Their guards are tough. Their guards are athletic. And when you have two big athletic guards at the top of that 2-3, and you have, like, Marvin Bagley or Wendell Carter or Javon Delorier and Gary Trent along that baseline, all that wingspan, it works.
Yeah.
Michigan State really had a tough time working the ball to the inside of that zone. Mm-hmm. They often had to work it to the wings, work it side to side, make 2 to 3 extra passes just to get it in the interior. And, you know, I think they said in the locker room after the game they were very surprised to see how much 2-3 Duke was running, and it threw them for a loop. You could tell.
And I think if they knew that much was coming, then you probably spend the last week or maybe the last month with Jaren Jackson working the middle in your zone offense and trying to figure out how to work through it that way, because they had, like you said, they didn't have anyone to kind of facilitate through in the middle or work any kind of inside outside or anything, or they couldn't even swing the ball enough to move the zone.
Nope.
No.
Nope. And we have to get to Elevision Castle. Before we do that, Scott, give me the Miles Bridges quote from talking about the zone, and we'll get out of here.
So he said that he was surprised that Duke went 2-3 because they did it against lower major teams. He didn't expect them to do it against a higher major team. He thought that they would play man, and he was certainly in for a rude awakening along with his Michigan State teammates.
And that wasn't even the most shade that anybody threw about that zone. Coach Cal, in his press conference, said, I believe this is as close to a direct quote as I can get off the top of my head, being up since 5 a.m. He said that he and his staff thought about playing 40 minutes of zone. They decided not to at the last minute. His staff talked him out of it, and he said, because it's easier to play zone, it's harder to teach your kids how to play man-to-man.
The petty wars continue.
All right, guys. Thank you for tuning in. Brendan, thank you for joining us.
Of course.
Scott, you were here.
Yeah, I was here. We were in the concourse.
Jameson is not going to bring himself.
That's great. Right.
Into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig, inspiring kid confidence.